In this episode, we're pulling back the curtain on intimate partner homicide, the risk factors, the role of firearms and protective orders, and why leaving is the most dangerous time. If you want to understand how to spot red flags and save lives, this is for you. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Jill Messing and Jacinia Pizarro are joining us. Jessie Pizarro is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. Her research examines the situational causes of violence, how violent crime is handled in the justice system, and strategies for prevention. Jill Messing is a professor of social work and director of the Office of Gender-Based Violence at Arizona State University. She focuses on developing and testing IPV risk assessments and using them to prevent intimate partner homicide. Today, Jill, Jessie, and I will be discussing what intimate partner violence, homicide, and femicide really mean, the risk factors and warning signs that violence could turn fatal, why protective orders, firearms, and systemic barriers matter so much in prevention, and the changes needed at community and policy levels to save lives. Jill and Jessie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you both. So I'd love if, for our listeners, each of you could share a little bit about yourselves and really how you got to where you are today.
I'll let Jill go first because she was the one who brought me into this world.
Hey. So great. So I'm a professor in the School of Social Work. So, and as a social worker, I'm really interested in how can we integrate social services for survivors into the police response to domestic violence. So often women reach out for help for domestic violence, but then aren't finding the resources that they need. And so my main kind of areas of research are how do we develop interventions that will work for survivors? And then also, how do we identify those survivors who are most at risk for homicide so that we can prevent those homicides?
And so I, as you mentioned, I'm a professor in criminology and criminal justice, and most of my work for the bulk of my career focus on lethal violence and just general homicide and firearm use in general homicide. And about 6-7 years ago, Jill approached me and she was like, with your expertise on homicide, would you be interested in collaborating on a project that looks at intimate partner homicide? And I got into the world of gender-based violence and with a more specific focus on intimate partner homicide.
This is such important work, and we're going to have I'm looking forward to our conversation for sure. So globally, this is shocking. 1 in 3 women experience IPV, intimate partner violence, in their lifetime by an intimate partner or ex-partner. And this includes psychological, physical, and or sexual abuse. Is that correct?
Yes. So, you know, when we think about intimate partner violence, I think it's really important to identify that we're not just talking about physical violence, right? So when I'm going to use intimate partner violence and domestic violence interchangeably.
Okay.
So there is, right, physical violence is obviously a problem, and it is extremely damaging for women's health, mental health, and it's really common. But when I think about domestic violence, I like to use Evan Stark's force of control model because it gives us a really good kind of perspective on what we mean by domestic violence. So it's not just kind of like discrete incidents of physical violence, right? It's a model of coercive control. And so when Evan Stark talks about it, he talks about 4 different types of, or like forms of abuse within relationships. And those are obviously physical violence, and that encompasses physical violence and sexual violence. But then there's also intimidation, control, and isolation. And when all of those things are coming together, it helps us to better understand how domestic violence is really a pattern of what he calls coercive control, but a mm-hmm. pattern of power and control in a relationship that really affects every aspect of that relationship. And so, you know, most victims of domestic violence are not experiencing physical violence like constantly, right? That happens sometimes, right. Certainly. But there's all of these other tactics, like tactics of control, tactics of intimidation that are occurring at the same time. And violence is often only used as like a reminder of what could happen if the survivor like pushes back against that coercive control. So mm-hmm. it helps us to understand, like to think about it in kind of a broader way, helps us to understand why survivors often feel like high levels of fear and entrapment in their relationships, even when there's not like super high levels of physical violence.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And now let's talk about a little bit about, I mean, obviously intimate partner homicide, when there's a death, we know that, and femicide. What is that?
So when we look at intimate partner deaths,
right,
in an intimate partner homicide, and then just looking at a femicide, that's just the killing of a woman. And uh-huh. it's important to recognize that men could be victims of intimate yes. partner homicides, too. These are generally rare events. So when we're looking at homicides in general, they make up anywhere between 10 to 20% of the total homicides that occur in the countries. It would be about, so on average now we're getting about 15,000 people that are victims of homicide. So that's about 10 to 20% depending on the year. And, but so when we're looking at it just at the death part and the culmination of death, it's rare. And I don't know, Jill, I'm sure you have other things to add in terms of the larger context of domestic violence and intimate partner violence.
Sure. And I think kind of going off what Jesse's talking about is that, right, there's like the world of homicide, right? And so when you look at homicides in the U.S., about 5 to 10% of homicides of men are committed by an intimate partner, whereas about 40 to 50% of homicides of women are committed by an intimate partner. So what we see is that intimate partners are kind of a large group of perpetrators of homicide mm-hmm. of women. And mm-hmm. when a woman is killed by an intimate partner, in the most cases, so in like 3/4 of cases, there was intimate partner violence prior to that homicide. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing I should say on the flip side of that is that when men are killed by an intimate partner, in the majority of cases, the man was abusive to the woman prior to that homicide. Mm-hmm. So men's violence against women precedes most intimate partner homicides, whether
okay. like really in retaliation, defense of themselves, something mostly defense, right?
So when women kill their male partners, it's primarily in defense. Yeah.
In defense. Now, you know, when we talk about this issue, intimate partner homicide, it's really not confined to one domain because it impacts so much more than I think general people really realize, right? Because we're talking healthcare, law, and government broadly. It's more than just a crime issue. Would you agree?
Yes.
You could vote first.
Yes.
Well, I would agree too.
Obviously, homicides are crimes. I think one thing to really think about is that when there's an intimate partner homicide, there's also what we call homicide survivors. And so the people who are left behind, often children are often either present or in proximity to the homicide when there's an intimate partner homicide. And then those children are left, right, without any parents, right? Because their mom was killed, and then their father figure is going to jail, and so then these children are left with no caregivers and a lot of trauma.
Yeah, trauma.
But then also when we think about intimate partner violence more generally, it's a health issue. Intimate partner violence results in multiple health problems, so not only those immediate injurious consequences of intimate partner violence, but there's also, chronic issues that occur due to chronic domestic violence, mental health issues. It increases depression, anxiety. And so it's really an issue that we need to think about in terms of kind of a holistic, right? Like holistic service systems, right? Like people need help not only from the criminal legal system, but also from social services and from health services as well.
You know, one thing I wanted to add, and this is one of the good things about, I feel like the masterfulness of us collaborating and Jill approaching me 6 years ago, is that it's not just a social work issue. It's a criminal justice is involved. Medicine is involved. So if you're going to approach intimate partner violence with an aim at prevention, you sort of need to have all like the relevant people that are can enact a change and that can lead to prevention. So, of course, in criminal justice and criminology, it's all about the response after the fact. So what do you do with a batterer and when they call the police? But obviously, there's so many other important perspectives that happen before or after, so like the medical field, social work for services for survivors before things escalate, but then also the aftermath and what happens when things were in near fatal events and even in fatal events, because then there is an aftermath. There are often survivors and things that are also going to need healing and services so that the cycle of violence does not continue.
Yeah, it's definitely not, it's not just a woman's issue, for sure. Mm-hmm. It is a global human issue that is definitely affects so many people. Now, when you began your research, so the two of you joined together, right, to research in Arizona, the Intimate Partner Homicide Study, correct? Is that, if I'm using that right? And what were you looking maybe to fill in the blanks? Like, what was the goal when you two started this as far as like, hey, this is what we want. This is the gap in the research and what people know that we are trying to fill. And did that work?
Yeah, I'll let Jill answer this because she was the one who recruited everybody.
Okay.
She was the one who brought the team together, so she could tell you about her vision.
So my mentor, Jackie Campbell, in the late 90s conducted a study that looked at what are the risk factors for intimate partner homicide. So she gathered information about homicides from multiple large cities across 11 states, I believe. And so what she was doing was looking to see, like, what are the risk factors that predict intimate partner homicide? How can we identify particular things that occur within a relationship that would tell us, like, oh, this is very high danger. This is high risk. This is something we really need to pay attention to and do, homicide prevention strategies. Or what I would say is, this is where we really need to integrate some social services, right? Mm-hmm. To get some safety for survivors and their kids. So that research was done in the late 90s, and here we are in 2025. And at the time, it was 2020. So there we were.
2019. And it was before the world stopped.
Yes.
Yeah, 2019.
2019. And we started thinking, what has changed from the time that original study was done? Are these risk factors still the same risk factors that that there were 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so our aim was to gather information about intimate partner homicides and then also from intimate partner violence survivors to kind of compare those cases to say, like, okay, what types of things, what types of violence, what structural or systemic barriers are in place that in these homicide cases that are not present in cases where we have a domestic violence survivor. So somebody who was not killed by their partner, but is experiencing abuse. And so we wanted to better understand those risk factors, but then also not only understand risk factors, but understand protective factors. So what are those things that can help us as social workers or as professionals help survive to mitigate those risks? And then how can we also better understand these risk factors for broader populations of folks? So that first study only looked at intimate partner femicide, right? Bringing back that those terms we were talking about earlier. So it was only women who were killed by men, but we wanted to look more broadly at what are the risk factors and cases of, you know, maybe men killed by women or women who are killed by a woman that they're in an intimate relationship with. So across different couple configurations, we wanted to look also at more rural areas. So the original study had only looked at big cities. So we wanted to be kind of more broad in terms of where we were looking at the populations for those risk factors.
And this is a big question, but then, well, Jesse, I want you to go, but then I want to know, like, what'd you find out? Right. In a day or less, right? I know it'll take you a long time to tell me, but anyway.
So Jill started putting together a team of people that, and we're truly a transdisciplinary team. So It's not just me, Jackie Campbell's still involved, who's in nursing, and we have other people. But like when she came to me to talk about this, I've always been, I like the idea of doing things for prevention and not just science for the sake of science. So I was all in where she was like, oh, we're going to test this study where everybody who studies homicide knows of the femicide study. And we are going to reconfigure risk assessment tools and try to do something with these findings so that we can help save some lives. Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I mean, I know that we can talk about the whole show, but like, what basically did you succeed in learning?
So we're still working on data analysis.
Yes.
This is, right, the long arc of research. But I think some of the things that we can talk about in terms of risk factors for intimate partner homicide are some of the big ones, right, are strangulation. So strangulation is a risk factor for homicide. So if a partner has strangled, or often in colloquial terms, people call it choking, but that's not actually the technical term. If somebody has strangled their partner, they're at higher risk for killing that partner. When there's a firearm in the home, there's a higher risk of intimate partner homicide. And one of the things that we're looking at in our study is if there are differential risks in terms of how that firearm is kept, or if somebody has multiple firearms. So if that firearm is kept locked up, is that safer than if somebody has, you know, their easy access to the firearm? Threats. So threats, particularly threats to kill or threats with a weapon, are particularly dangerous. So those are the things that come to mind immediately. Jesse, do you have a couple others?
So we're digging into the data right now. So we did. So this study was just not in Arizona. Okay. We had the great idea to do this in six entire states. So we collected data from six states, and one of those states is Texas, which is massive.
Right.
But so we're still digging into the data, but some of the preliminary things that have stood out to me when we're looking at this is that a lot of the time, as we suspected, the majority of these incidents are committed with a firearm. We also have found from some of our interviews that when perpetrators who did kill with a firearm generally had multiple firearms that weren't properly secured, that were very easy to access. We've also found across the six states that there was some help seeking, but that the victims didn't really get the help that, obviously, because the incident escalated. And there was some issues also with like mental illness and the part of perpetrators. But yeah, but we're still digging a lot into those data, and we are hoping to unveil them soon.
Now, what about, like, in some of the preliminary things you've seen, let's talk about the perpetrators, their level of education. Have you found anything emerging about that, or, you know, whether they're employed?
In the original study, unemployment was a risk factor, but we haven't seen anything.
Seen that yet? Yeah. Okay,
nothing has popped out in this one that makes me think about it.
Okay.
In terms of it, but we... In the original study, that's one of the highest risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
which is unemployment.
And earlier, the importance of looking not only at individual risk factors, but also at like structural barriers.
Okay.
So I think it's really important to think about, you know, when we think about not only what's going on in that relationship, but like what's going on in society that, you know, sets the stage for intimate partner violence and homicide. And so I think it's really important that we're thinking not only about, unemployment as like an individual failing, right? That's also a structural failing. And so we need to be kind of careful about that.
Interesting. Okay. Now let's talk about, certainly in the original study, but is there a large percentage of victims that have experienced prior abuse before the homicide? Or are you not? I mean, that's definitely showing up, right? Yes, that's showing up.
Yes. So in the vast majority of the interviews that we've conducted, there was intimate partner violence before the homicide. Mm-hmm. And then in the original study, it was about 75%. So in 75% of intimate partner homicides, there was intimate partner violence prior, which just makes sense, right? Usually it's not something that happens out of the blue. Usually there's, you know,
it's building. It builds and builds.
And that we saw that same pattern here. And one of the questions that we generally ask when we do our interviews with proxy informants, there's a question there that was like, did the victim believe that? And I say she and he because these are the majority of them. Did she believe that he would kill her? And the majority of the cases, they did believe that would escalate.
I had the benefit of, you know, meeting someone and becoming friends with a woman who was a victim of domestic violence and in a situation where she was in law enforcement as well as her husband, partner at that time. And this was for somebody who's done the research, right? And who is not familiar, you know, that she talked about like a really severe beating, a very, very difficult thing, you know, and the police were there and all that, people who knew her. But instead of that being like, now I got to get out, she said that's when she knew he could kill her. And that almost made her even more, it did, because it's not like then right after that she left, then she knew, okay, he means it and he can do it because of that. And that was just kind of really, you know, I thought, wow, I think from those of us on the outside, right, who aren't, you know, would think, oh, man, they're leaving for sure now, right? Like, I mean, that was a horrific event. But so because of all the things you've talked about where, you know, people have been in these relationships, there's a lot of abuse. I mean, but that is true, right? Like they just exhibited to you, they can do all the things they've been saying or make it work. So anyway, I found that really interesting. I think what you're talking about, you know, the prior violence. And is that why, or I guess help me understand why, where you said a big or an indicator of later homicide is strangulation in particular.
What?
Yes,
The first thing I just want to say is that I think one of the things that like people often say when you hear about intimate partner violence or like your friend, and they're like, oh, why, you know, you expect them to be like, okay, now I'm leaving, right? Or like that, you know, I think I hear a lot people saying like, oh, if that ever happened to me, I would just leave. And I think it's a really big myth that is, you know, what people that people who are experiencing domestic violence or intimate partner violence can just leave their partners, right? Because I think if we're, there's a few things. One is that separation is one of the most dangerous times for intimate partner violence survivors. And so to say like, well, you should just leave, that could actually increase danger for the survivor, right?
Okay.
So it's really important And then if we're thinking about leaving, people are also thinking about having a safety plan. How do you safely leave? So some of the advice that we give as a social worker, some of the advice that I would give is to make sure that the person leaves, they don't tell their partner they're leaving. They leave at a time when their partner's not there, not home, or they have a place to go that's safe where their partner can't find them, that they have all of the things that they need. So they have their documents. They have, they have their clothes. They have things for their kids, right? Another thing, speaking of kids, another thing that a lot of people are dealing with when they're experiencing intimate partner violence is if they do leave, then they also need to have safety plans for their children. So are they going to take their children with them? And then if we're thinking about like divorce or custody situations, how is that going to play out in the court system with their children? And so a lot of times people stay in order to protect their children because they know that if they're there, they can protect their children. But if they're not there, they're not there. They can't protect their kids. And then also people may not have like the financial resources to leave. So there's so many things to think about. And so just saying like, oh, well, somebody should leave, or if that happened to me, I would just leave. There's so many more considerations. And I think we need to be really, really careful about, making sure that people have, again, the systems in place that they need in order to leave.
Right. I think that's a common thing that maybe hopefully not as much now that you hear, right? There's more education than say 20 years ago, but still it's a thing that people say. It's like, they have no idea. Like you said, just one that increases the likelihood of their death, the danger. Mm-hmm. It's just so many more things. It's not that mm-hmm. easy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so it's really important that people think about that when we're thinking about, and also how do we advise survivors? Like if you have a friend who's in an abusive relationship, what are the things that you can do to help them and to make sure that you're educated as well about how to best do that?
So I do want to touch on why the strangulation, you think plays is showing up as a predictor mm-hmm. of later homicide.
Yeah. Strangulation is really dangerous. I mean, I think that is, it's really scary and it's really super dangerous. And I think that is one of, I think is the main reason is that it's actually really easy to kill someone by strangling them and to do it maybe even not intentionally. But it also is used often as a tactic of power and control. So strangulation is really scary for the person who is being strangled. And so they're often like trying to avoid that in the future. Like I had a client one time who told me that her partner had strangled her early on in the relationship. And from then on, all he had to do was like make a move toward, if they're arguing, all he had to do was make a move toward doing something like that. And she would back down like immediately because it was so scary to her. So that's part of that control, right? Is like somebody is using that. They're using that one instance of violence to control and intimidate someone for the remainder of their relationship. So I think that's both a good example of how scary and dangerous strangulation is, but also how that power and control works in intimate relationships.
Let's talk about the effectiveness of protective orders in reducing risk.
It depends on how you look at so studies vary, right? And the reason that studies vary is because the United States is, as a country, we're complex when it comes to firearms and laws about surrounding firearms, because every state does things a little different, right? Mm-hmm. But we know that in general, if you look at protective orders in general, they're relatively effective, but it could vary by state and the laws that the state has. And it's not just simply about having protective order or a firearm, you know, some of the DVROs, domestic violence restraining orders, because you could have that in a state. But if you're in a state that has a DVRO or protective order, but they don't have any firearm relinquishment laws,
yes,
it's very different. And even if they have a relinquishment law, only 7 states have a system in place to make sure that the perpetrator gets rid of their guns, right? So in some states, it's like an honor system. Like, yeah, you're a violent, you're a domestic batterer, and we're going to expect you to go and give up your gun, and we're going to believe that you're going to do it. Versus if you're in one of the 7 states that have a process in place, police will actually come to your house and take your gun. All that is to say is that it's complicated.
Right.
When you're looking at the data and what results, I think that one of the things that one way that we could look at it is asking petitioners, like, do you feel more safe? And what some of the research tells us is that generally petitioners feel more safe when they have a restraining order. So it's hard to say yes or no because of all the complexities. And I don't know, Joe, if you have anything to add. We're in a complicated country and system.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. I've done a couple of studies on orders of protection, and one of them was about barriers. And one of the people that we interviewed said that, you know, a piece of paper is not going to stop her partner, right? So it really depends also, I would say, on how willing the perpetrator is to follow that civil protective
order.
And the other thing that I think is really important is that when we think about orders of protection, we're still putting the onus on the survivor. So the survivor has to go, they have to get the order of protection, right? So it's a really tends to be a long and complicated court process. And then so they go and they get the order of protection, then that order of protection has to be served to be in effect. So they need to either in some states, people have to serve them themselves or get a process server to serve them. And in other states, the police department or the sheriff's department will serve it. So then once it's served, then it protects, right? It usually what they do actually, orders of protection are super flexible. Like they can do a lot of things, but what they usually do is keep the perpetrator away from the survivor's home or workplace or other places where she tends to be, and away from her, right?
Yes.
But then also, if the perpetrator violates the order, say he does come to her home, it's her responsibility then to call the police and to tell the police that that happened, right? So it really is one of those things where in some cases it can be really effective.
Yes.
If the perpetrator chooses to follow that civil order. But in other cases, it's not effective because the perpetrator doesn't follow it.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things as a criminologist, one of the things in criminology we talk about a lot is offender decision making. And it's usually, and we talk about the motivated offender, right? But there's some offenders, you know, like with everything, that they're just going to be motivated to do it. And no matter what, especially if they're going through some mental illness crisis or if they already have suicidal ideation, piece of paper is not really going to have an effect on. But I want to state that even though that when we talk about that offender decision making, that's not all of them. You're going to get to some with, but you're obviously not going to get to those that are really, really motivated to engage in the crime.
Yeah, you know, we have that, obviously, that process in Florida. And, you know, as it's all we've got, right? So we do, you know, when those situations present, we do encourage our clients to get one. And yes, you do have to, you know, you have to abide by it and, you know, certainly call the police if they have violated. But there have been instances where, and pretty actually within the past few years in our local area where one wasn't granted, he left and killed her after that. And so the judge, you know, made the wrong decision clearly. And where oftentimes, and I don't know if this is part of your research, they get filed and even on the temporary. So in Florida, you know, it'll temporarily be granted or not, and then opportunity for due process and a hearing. But then the petitioner drops it, right? Because of that coercion, you know, all of those things, all the psychology within the relationships and giving them another chance and everything. And that we've seen some violence in this area in particular, and that's what shows up, right? There was, he did have one, but then, you know, it was dropped. And with our statute in the firearms, the law prohibits the person subject to an injunction from possessing the firearm, but you're right, it's not mandated that they surrender it to local law enforcement, but the court can order that. So, but again, that's something that has to be asked, or, you know, it would help. I think if that was mandatory, that would be one more step, right, in protecting from that a homicide, you know, if the firearms were removed.
Yes, and that's an issue in Florida. And it's not to point out Florida, obviously only 7 states have a process in place to get them removed. So it's an issue.
The majority. It is. I mean, you know, like we were talking about, this is not just some isolated thing. This affects many areas within a community. Well, let's talk a little bit, though, about the role of law enforcement intervention. You know, like, for example, cases like the Gabby Petito, where an arrest, like, wasn't made. You know, how do we speak to that?
I think just in general, one way to do this, and I work a lot with law enforcement, and I've seen the whole spectrum, right? Very progressive law enforcement and police departments that have designated domestic violence unit and chiefs that send their domestic violence unit to trainings. And again, we have 18,000 police departments in this country. And even within the same state, every police department I think one of the ways and one of the things that we need to do is educate and educate more the police officers on what are these are the risk factors. What are some of the things that they should be in the lookout for when they get a call for service? Incorporate some of these things in their academy training, but it has to be also something from the top down, right? The top will set down the culture of how do we treat women and how do we think about gender-based violence, and that then is communicated to the officers. But it's about education.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the times when I've seen officers in both spectrums, sometimes it's not so much that the officers are like bad and don't care about women, but it's more that they're just ignorant and they don't have the education, or is a cultural issue within the police department. And police culture is very important, but it varies by place. Yeah.
So my work has focused for quite some time on helping police officers to identify what are those really dangerous cases. So what we often do is we ask police departments to use risk assessments at the scene of domestic violence incidents. And so we ask them to have officers ask some of these questions, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's two things. One is that when police officers go out to a domestic violence incident, they're only focusing on what happened right now, today, right? That's their job. Their job is to say, like, what happened in this incident? Is there a chargeable offense? And then if there is a chargeable offense, they're going to, you know, go on and hopefully arrest the person and charge them, assuming that the person is there still, right? So in something like 50% of cases when police officers show up at domestic violence incidents, the offender has already fled. And so that's a little bit of an aside. But what we're trying to get them to do with the risk assessments is to not only focus on, like, okay, what happened right now, but also what is the context that this is occurring in? So what happened in this, what has been happening up to date in this relationship?
Right.
And actually, I'm just going to, that reminds me of what I was going to say about strangulation before, which is that it often doesn't leave any marks, right? So let's say that a survivor is strangled by her partner. And so when the police officers, and she is scratching and hitting to get away, right? And so when the police officers show up, she doesn't have any marks on her body, but the offender is all scratched up in his face, right? And so then what is the officer seeing? The officer is seeing the person with the injury. So they focus on those visible injuries because that's what they're trained to do. And so with risk assessment, one of the things, so officers should definitely have training on strangulation. That's really important. And it's important that they know how dangerous that is, that there are mechanisms for taking photos like blue light imaging and things like that, that it can occur in hospitals where they can see the damage to the survivor, even if there's no like external marks. So that's the part Jesse was talking about, right? About education. So it's really important that they understand that officers are educated about not only domestic violence in general, but all of these kind of like specific things that occur with domestic violence. But then also with the risk assessments, what we're trying to do is to get officers to focus not only on what happened right now, but what is the context of that relationship? Is this violence occurring as part of, you know, an ongoing coercive controlling relationship? We're having them ask questions like, in this relationship, you know, has there been strangulation in the past? Has your partner threatened to kill you? Has your partner threatened you with a weapon? And so asking questions about these risk factors not only gives that officer information about the risk that's present in this situation, but it also gives them information about the context of the relationship. So one of the things that we think is that this helps officers to write better reports. It helps them to identify, right, who is that, like, in some states have like primary aggressor laws, right? So who is the primary aggressor in this relationship? What is, what happened in this situation, and how is it related to what has happened in the past? And then when somebody is at high risk, we ask them to put the survivor in touch with a social service provider, right? So when officers, again, right, they're police officers. So their job is to go out there, look at the incident, you know, identify the chargeable crime, and then arrest the person who committed the crime. But when someone experiences domestic violence, and especially if they're in an ongoing domestic violence relationship, even if the police officer takes away the perpetrator, takes them to jail, that they're often only there for like 12 or 24 hours. And then they're back out. And in that time, the survivor needs to have a plan, right? She needs to know what she's going to do, what she's going to do with her kids, what she's going to do with her stuff. Is she going to stay at the house? Should she be getting an order of protection? So there's so many, right? She's just experienced a traumatic incident. The police have come to her house. None of these things are, you know, what any of us want to be doing, you know, with our afternoon or Friday night or whatever.
Right.
So it's a whole, she's in this, she's been traumatized. And so it's really important that we're also giving services to the survivor at that time and saying like, okay, what are some of the things that you can do right here, right now to help make yourself safer, to help make your kids safer, to make sure that you get the services that you need, whether they be medical services, whether they be social services, housing services, whatever those are. So I think it's really important to think about this again as like a holistic holistic problem where we need not only to have, you know, consequences or accountability for offenders, but we also need to have services for survivors to help them, you know, in the situation.
You know, one thing I want to add is that what some police departments have done and show a lot of promise is have crisis intervention teams, special crisis intervention teams that go out on calls. Mm-hmm. Particularly of domestic violence, where there is a service provider that's on call that goes out with the police officer. And those types of things have shown promise. and getting women the help that they need.
Yeah, and especially in that instance where he's been arrested. Okay, so there, you have a set amount of time. It may not be a lot, but if there could be an intervention team, I could see where that would be a very great time. That where if she's given some resources, because then that provides maybe options that otherwise she's unaware of.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And without that, right, she's left at home.
Yeah.
And the partner, her partner is taken away, but he's coming back.
So.
Yeah. Without, I think it's really important at that time in that crisis that we're providing services.
Yeah. So. My gosh. So if, can you even highlight one thing, or maybe each of you can pinpoint a couple of things? Like, I know you're not done with all of, you know, your 5 years of research. Obviously, that takes a long time to get through and come up with your solid conclusions, but some highlights that of warnings, maybe if anything that we haven't already talked about, but for our listeners to know, or maybe if we have listeners and they know somebody, right? Because that's really powerful as well. Like helping family, other people under this more so that it's not just this, you know, thing behind closed doors that, you know, the rest of us aren't acknowledging or aware of, but something to highlight maybe that you've learned thus far.
I know, no pressure. What's the one thing I want everyone to know? So I think, I mean, we've talked about a lot of those risk factors. I think if, you know, if we're talking about someone who's experiencing domestic violence, or you think you are, domestic violence, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is a really good resource. It's anonymous. You can call, you can talk to somebody who knows about safety planning and knows about domestic violence, even if you're like, hey, is this like, this doesn't feel right to me, right? Like, is this something that that I'm experiencing? No problem to reach out for resources, right? I think domestic violence is something we often don't talk about because people feel ashamed about it. They feel like survivors, right? Feel ashamed. So I think it's really important to know that it's not your fault and that there are resources to reach out to. And I think that would be the other thing that I would say for people who think that they know somebody or who do know somebody who's experiencing domestic violence. I think it's really important to talk to that person and to go at that without judgment, right? So to say like, hey, I think, you know, it seems to me like y'all are having a hard time. Tell me, like, what's going on? Is this something that's happening? There are resources. So My Plan is an app that I've been working on for quite some time, which is a really good resource, both for survivors. There's versions for survivors and versions for people who are friends or family. If you think somebody is in a dangerous situation, you can use the app. It's myplanapp.com is the web version, or it's on the app store and just search My Plan app. But that's a really good place to take a look and see, like, is your relationship healthy? Are you experiencing some of these risk factors for intimate partner homicide? And then also it connects folks to resources. So that is a really good resource. But I would say that it's really important to reach out for help if you think that it's something you're experiencing, or if you think that somebody that you know or love is experiencing domestic violence, to be there for them and to be there for them without judgment.
Yeah, I think of two things. One of them is, like, if he tells you he's going to kill you, believe him. Because a lot of times, and I say he, but it could be a she too. But you know, one of the things I've learned and that I've been amazed in the past 5 to 6 years that I've been in this line of work with intimate partner is, like, how committed and how tenacious are the advocates that work with this population. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me how they're there and they'll give, like, their shirts off their back to help somebody that's in crisis. So there is help out there. So if you think that no one's going to do anything or that no one understands, I'm like, I would say, like, it's important to reach out and look for, like, your local or state coalition and reach out, because there are people and advocates and people out there that are committed to helping. So you don't have to go through this by yourself. There are people out there that will help you. if you reach out. Don't suffer in silence. That's what I would say.
Awesome. Well, Jill and Jesse, before we go, it blew by. This is so much stuff. And I mean, we could, like I say, talk for hours on all the things that you've already learned and studied. But before we go, our show is called Women Winning Divorce. And I'd love to hear from each of you what winning at life means to you.
Another small question. I think, you know, for me, being able to have people in my life who love and care about me and who I love and care about is really important. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately, I studied intimate partner homicide for 20 years. And one of the things I've actually been thinking about a lot lately is like backing that up and saying, like, what are those things that make a relationship healthy and meaningful? And so I think that maybe that'll be the next stage of my career is what are those things that we can teach ourselves and teach young people about how to have relationships that are based on mutual respect and caring. But I think that that is what it would be for me, is to be in a community with people who respect me and whom I respect, and where we're, where we're kind to each other. I think it's so important.
Yes, I agree. Jesse?
So winning at life, I'm going to say something really corny, so okay, Don't laugh at me, but it's, it's about being happy with what you do, right? Waking up in the morning, and yeah, we have to work, and work is not like the ideal thing, but like, you know, at least not having a sense of dread of what you're going to do in your day, and having that work mean something to someone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's my corny response.
Well, I love it. I love it. I do agree as well. And so lastly, where can our listeners find each of you for more information and resources?
So we work at Arizona State University.
Yeah.
You can find us, at our works. I have social media. That's probably more what you're thinking about, right? I have social media for my office. So the Office of Gender-Based Violence at Arizona State University.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, look us up in the Office of Gender-Based Violence. And obviously, Jill has My Plan that people can look into. But Office of Gender-Based Violence, Arizona State University, that's where our respective pages are. Find out a little bit about us.
Well, thank you both so much. We've reached the end of our show today. It has really been a pleasure for you both to provide your time and insight. Jill Messing and Jacinia Pizarro for joining us to discuss intimate partner violence, risk factors for homicide, and urgent steps we need to take as a society to prevent these tragedies. Thank you both.
Wonderful. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.